old cowpoke was riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, bound through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw. Brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. The horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. For he saw the riders coming hard and he heard their mournful cry. Riders in the sky, their faces gaunt, their eyes were blurred, their shirts all soaked with sweat. They're riding hard to catch that herd, but they ain't caught them yet. Cause they've got to ride forever in that range up in the sky, on horses snorting fire as they ride on. Hear their cry. Yippee-yi-yi. Save your soul from hell or riding on our rain. Then cowboy, change your ways today or with us you will ride, trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies.
In listening to that recording by Burl Ives, the first recording of a song made popular not only by Burl Ives, but Johnny Cash and Vaughn Monroe and many others, I couldn't help but think that's 1947, and that song, which I picked out for reasons that will become obvious in just a moment, but the song became even more appropriate because I realized it contains many things in it that I wasn't thinking it had in terms of popular culture, in terms of musical developments, in terms of things that happened way in the past, the 19th century cowboy song, and way into the future in terms of the type of music. And that made it all the more appropriate for our discussion today with Lee Sandlin, a great Chicago writer you may not have heard of, or if you've heard of him, you may not know that he's a Chicagoan. And Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers, is out now. It follows another wonderful nonfiction work, Wicked River, the Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild, and parallels the issue as a paperback original in book form of a series you may recall from When the Reader Was the Reader.
Those were the days.
It was a 12-part series
originally? It was, yeah.
That has been published as a memoir or a profile or inspection of a family, of his own family, the Distancers. Lee Sandlin, S-A-N-D-L-I-N, is our guest today, and Ghost Riders was a song I thought of as soon as I received the book, and in fact, Lee discusses it in the book as well as he talks about this concept of tornado chasing, which may sound cable television, but its past, its present, and its future includes cable television, but is not only about that. Lee, thanks so much for joining us, and I'm glad that we're finally having a chance to catch up about your wonderful writing.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Let's start with Storm Kings,
okay,
and we'll work our way back and forth
right
with Mississippi, and next time we'll talk about family writing, because it's a different kind of writing, too.
Sure, I think. Yeah.
You have insatiable curiosity, mm-hmm, it would appear, from reading your books. You find a topic, and you go forward, backward, side to side, in every which way. What is the initial motivation?
Well, I think that one of the things I most like about history is the idea of immersing yourself in some kind of alien culture. I think of my writing as, in a peculiar way, a kind of science fiction, in that the books that I've written about 19th century America, there's that famous saying, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And when I started researching the first book, the Mississippi River book, I started thinking, the past is really kind of an alien planet. It's not just another country. And so I thought the best way to describe that, the best way to get readers into it, was not to do some sort of sociological study, but to make it as directly immersive as possible.
You do sociology, intentionally or not, though, within the narrative that you,
sure,
lay out.
Sure, but more by implication than
right
by direct. You know,
right,
I'm much more interested in describing the primary experience that people had, both with tornadoes and with the Mississippi River, of getting as close as possible to what people really experienced firsthand, which takes a lot of research, but I think the payoff is considerable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One of the ways that you do this, and one of the ways I think a person can initially make that connection, is by talking about the people as well as the nature.
I mean, sure,
you you have a wonderful hook in many ways with the tornado book, because everybody knows or thinks that he knows the story of Benjamin Franklin.
Sure, yeah.
So tell us about why Benjamin Franklin is here and in many ways becomes a touchstone for the things that you wind up telling us about nature, about science, about reputation, about celebrity, which are all related to tornadoes.
They really kind of are, yeah. That's the fascinating thing. Well, Franklin was fascinating because he really was historically the first tornado chaser in a very literal way. I found in one of his letters an account of he was riding with some of his friends through the Maryland countryside, and a small funnel cloud formed in the distance.
Mm.
And everyone else hung back, panicked by what this was, and he went riding after it.
Mm.
And according to his letter, he claimed that he was riding alongside it and lashing it with his riding crop. Now, I don't know whether he was actually doing that or not, but it's a good image, you know.
The hair flowing in the
exactly,
wind.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And he's just, you know, damn you, slashing at it. But he was also fascinated by weather generally. He
right
was somebody, this is one of the things that's really interesting about him, because people take him as this model for prudence and responsibility and order. But when you read his letters and you read his memoirs, you start realizing he really was a kind of a flighty guy. I mean, you know, a lot of this advice about sticking to things was advice he was trying to give to himself,
mm,
because his mind was just going everywhere in all, mm, kinds of directions. And he had gotten interested in weather only indirectly. He was interested in figuring out what electricity was. And he made a number of major discoveries about electricity and then moved on to weather. And appears to have been the first person to conceive of the idea that there could even be such a thing as a tornado.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, they knew about water spouts, but there were no scientific records of tornadoes, except very few scattered references to them. And he was the first person to think, well, there could be a water spout over land. And it was a sort of, it's an American form of weather that had been previously unsuspected. So that kind of starts with him.
What is it that makes it an American form of weather?
Well, it's interesting because tornadoes can theoretically form anywhere. They've been reported on every continent except Antarctica. but they're very rare in most of the world. With America, you have this fluke of geography where you have this immense open plains in the center of the country where very hot air from the, and humid air from the Gulf of Mexico flows up and meets very cold air coming down from Canada. And for a tornado to form, you need that clash of these two air masses.
So it's this combination of a unique topography
right.
and a unique placement between weather systems that
exactly.
are opposites,
yeah,
basically.
Exactly. It also happens actually in Bangladesh, where there is cold air flowing down from the Himalayas meeting warm air coming up from the Indian Ocean. And they also see tornadoes, not as often, but they form there. That's the only place I know of where they form with any kind of regularity.
And do they call them tornadoes? Or?
I think they call them typhoons there, but, you know, it's still, you know, weather systems, weather reporting in the rest of the world isn't, especially in a country as poor as Bangladesh,
right.
is very rudimentary. And this is one of the problems because they have no system for alerting their populace to the presence of bad storms. The highest death toll on record from a tornado was in Bangladesh, where several thousand people died in mm-hmm. one tornado, which is much worse than anything that's ever happened in America.
Though some pretty bad things have
there
happened.
There have been horrendous tornadoes here, yes.
And we'll come to them. Let's just get some more of the terms
oh,
out
yeah,
there,
sure.
too. Water spout.
Yeah.
And what is that? And then, of course, the basic thing that has to be explained to people if they move from a coast into the center of the country,
yes.
difference between a hurricane and a tornado.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting is that none of those terms have been very clear to people until very recently. You can find in earlier descriptions of the weather terms like tornado and hurricane and gale and windstorm used interchangeably, sometimes in the same sentence, and which makes it very hard for if you're now looking back and trying to figure out what a particular storm was. I was looking at the worst tornado that's ever been recorded in Illinois was one that happened in 1805, and the descriptions I found in historical records described it as a tornado of the hurricane type.
Okay.
And I thought, that's not really as useful a description as I would think.
Yeah.
The word tornado was used in sailors' navigation in the 17th century, and then it appeared to be nothing more than a windstorm where the wind came from different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the only time that Franklin used the word tornado, he said, that's specifically what I'm not looking for.
Mm.
He was called what he was looking for a land spout. And the idea was a water spout is essentially a tornado that forms over water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's roughly the same because you've got humid air and you can have cold air coming in. So, but people assumed that a water spout was actually made out of water. And I think people still assume that. If you see one, because it looks like it's coming out of the sea up into mm-hmm. the clouds, people get the idea that it actually is a tube of water. And Franklin was the first person to realize that's not physically possible. Water's far too heavy. There's nothing on Earth that could raise that much water up.
Mm-hmm.
And that he realized it had to be a column of air. And what people were thinking was water was, in fact, just a cloud forming around the column. And that's what led him to think, well, if it happens over water, it could easily happen over land. There's mm-hmm. we don't need the water for that. And so that's why water spout and then land spout.
Had he been in the Midwest,
He might have seen it earlier.
Earlier. Right?
Yeah, the Native Americans knew all about tornadoes.
What did they think of them?
They had a lot of stories about them, and they had a lot of practical advice about them, which turned out to be entirely wrong.
Okay.
And which is one of the things about tornado experts I found kind of dismaying while researching this book, is that tornado advice is 400 years of bad advice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really been an amazing number of scientific experts coming forward to say things about tornadoes that were totally false.
This is another thing that runs through the book from the earliest sections on, is we all hear now debate not so much about global warming, but about global warming.
Sure, yeah.
We
yeah.
hear debate about where science fits in with policy.
Yeah.
And this goes in many, many different areas. And there are people who think, oh, maybe this is something contemporary. In fact,
it's been there
tornadoes
all along, yeah.
are all about science and policy and how poor each of them are.
Yes, and in a lot of ways, the debates we're hearing now about global warming, and I'm not a global warming skeptic, by the way, let me just stress that, but they're the same debates that were happening in the 19th century because people had the perception that there were a lot more tornadoes happening, largely because they're just better reported, and they were blaming deforestation for it. So mm-hmm. they were saying, but it's a similar notion, the weather is getting worse, mm-hmm. and we're doing something that's causing that. And now one of these times, in this case, it appears to be true, but that's a belief that people have had for centuries,
right.
is that we're directly affecting the weather for the worse.
We're speaking with Lee Sandlin. He is the author of three books, all in print right now, and the one we're talking about immediately is Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. And it is about both the tornadoes and those who study them, and that
sure,
sort of
yeah.
one illuminates, if a tornado can illuminate because it darkens the
yeah,
sky, doesn't
yeah.
it? But if one does illuminate the other. Franklin, we often forget how modern much of science is, how
sure,
recent it
yeah,
is.
Sure, yeah, it is.
So Franklin's looking around at electricity in the 18th century, yeah. mid to late 18th century, and he's also looking at weather.
Yeah.
Which you would think, oh, people must have been looking at weather and figuring out weather a long time ago. But
no, but this is one of the things that struck me is that you would assume that since one of the basic human activities going back as long as there have been human beings on the planet is goofing off from whatever it is you were supposed to be doing and lying on your back and looking at the clouds, that somebody would realize the clouds took on regular shapes. Mm-hmm. And as far as I can tell, nobody got that idea until 1804. This was actually when it was a man named Luke Howard. He was an amateur meteorologist in Britain, and he proposed that there were nine different types of clouds, and he named them, and then the names we have now, cumulus and cirrus and stratus, and all of that is new. People assume that must go back to the ancient Greeks, and it doesn't. And one of the ways you can prove it to yourself, if you don't believe me, is next time you're at any kind of art museum that's got Renaissance or earlier landscape paintings, look at the clouds in those paintings, mm-hmm. and they're always just gibberish in terms of scientific accuracy. Mm-hmm. People could observe the land clearly, but the clouds are just this mass of nonsense. And it wasn't until the 19th century, the Art Institute of Chicago has some amazing French Impressionist paintings where you see these meticulously correct clouds, and it jumps out at you because 200 years earlier in the Dutch paintings, it's just the smears of nonsense.
Well, when you think that people were not even interested in the idea that the Earth was the Earth,
yeah.
that it
yeah.
revolved around the sun, and
sure.
that
yeah.
the heavens might actually be circles of weather creation,
yeah.
maybe that there wasn't really a reason to think about clouds.
Yeah, and it's also, unless you understand something, it's hard to see it clearly. This mm-hmm. is one of the odd things about people. In before the 19th century, when people looked at the sky, they couldn't tell the difference between a cloud and a meteor. And in fact, the word meteorologist means upper air.
Right.
You study the upper air. These are just all strange things that happened in the sky. And nobody saw any regular patterns in them for a long, long time.
And, of course, they also saw pictures
yeah.
in the sky. And
sure.
they also thought pictures in the sky had something to do about whether or not we were going to get a raise at work.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, a sinister-looking cloud had to mean something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the same thing when they looked at tornadoes. One of the odd things about looking at 19th century accounts of tornadoes is how strange they are. And these were direct eyewitness accounts, and they were describing all these things that meteorologists now would say are impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But they were certain that they saw them, and they're certain that they heard them. The tornadoes sang, that they made strange noises, trumpet calls, they whistled, and that they were surrounded by lights, that there was a glowing eye at the heart of a tornado.
Some of that also, though, must have come from what were the reigning means of historical communication then. These are people who are going to be fairly steeped in the Bible.
Sure.
In its English language, King James form probably at that time. And also the general idea of of mythology and grandeur and mystery, that these are ghost tales and so
sure,
on, things that are very much coming out of the West at this time on this continent. And so, I mean, think about just when you see for the first time the Grand Canyon, or no matter how many pictures you've grown up with or the old Disney movies or something, you're just overawed. Now, what if you're someone who didn't even know that such a thing could exist and you're seeing it for the first time?
Yeah, that's a huge thing. And there's also, I mean, seeing a tornado was an astonishing experience for the first people who left records of it. They had no idea what they were looking at, but they just thought it was this. And also, again, going back to the idea of not knowing how to interpret things, I was in a tornado when I was 17 years old, and I didn't see any of the things that mark out a tornado. I didn't see a funnel cloud. I didn't, you know, I just happened to be standing at the front door of my house about to step outside, and a tornado is this weak tornado, but it passed down our street. And
this was where?
This was in Wilmette. And every single thing on the street suddenly blew up straight into the air, and it got pitch dark out. And then a second later, it was gone.
Right.
And there weren't any serious injuries. Some roofs got stove in by fallen trees. But I thought, well, that was a tornado. But afterwards, I remember thinking, was that a tornado? I don't know. And I'm was reasonably well-educated scientific background guy. And I was like, I still had no idea even what I had been through, even though I'd seen it.
Right.
So this is one of the things that I was, when I was reading these 19th century accounts, and there are dozens and dozens of them. This is a whole untapped historical field, really.
Right.
Is that I would find people describing the most extraordinary ways and thinking, is that actually what you saw, or is that how you made it up to yourself to try and interpret what you saw?
I'm thinking of having experienced minor earthquakes in the Bay Area. Everybody reports pretty much the same pattern. You think something's wrong with your house.
Right, yeah.
And then you think, oh, no, maybe this is something big, and then it's starting to end, and you're trying to remember what happened, and then it becomes more dramatic in your mind because you're afraid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some of this is this kind of
human reception
psychology.
And you never know what your training is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I had a friend who was in a major earthquake in L.A., and I said to her, did you know what to do? And she said, oh, yes, the earthquake preparedness worked perfectly. And I said, what did you do? And she said, I ran around the house naked, screaming, this is the big one. This is the big one. We're all going to die.
Okay.
And I was like, you know, so.
And she's still alive.
So
the 19th century, we have all these sightings. We have these reports in part as the population is coming into the white European population.
Sure, yeah.
Americans are coming into these areas. We also have people who decide for various reasons that they're going to explain these things to other people.
Yeah, the scientists
And some of them
up.
Are scientists, and some of them are entertainers, and some of them are
both.
Not
a big difference. Yeah, in those days, you know, it was very theatrical. They really had the concept of the scientist as superstar in a way that would surprise us now. I mean, there are scientists that people know about. I mean, people know about Stephen Hawking or something. But the notion of a scientist as celebrity really got going in a big way then. And it got going because there was popular debates. There was a thing called the Lyceum Movement that was big in the 1840s and later, where celebrities were traveling the circuit around America giving public debates, arguing with people in the audience or with each other. And one of the biggest names was a man named James Espy, who was a meteorologist, and he believed he had figured out the core of meteorology, which included tornadoes. Tornadoes he took as a proof of his theories, and he was great at arguing. He was great at these grand theories. He was a very handsome guy. He was a very beautiful speaker, and he could deal with opponents in this very sort of high-handed but still funny way. And he made his living traveling around arguing about the nature of tornadoes.
And what did he say the nature was? And then he has a rival at a certain point.
Yeah. Espy made a major conceptual breakthrough about meteorology. He's the person who discovered the importance of a phenomenon called convection in weather. People believed that air sort of circulated randomly in the atmosphere. And he was the first person to say, no, it follows distinct physical rules. And the principle is now called convection. And And he realized that storms and violent storms like tornadoes were the products of these columns of very hot rising air, transferring heat from the surface up to the upper atmosphere very quickly. And that's why these destructive storms would form. And he was entirely correct about that. The problem was that he had in his head this model of how it should work, and it was absolutely perfect and is clear, luminous, but it was slightly wrong. And one of the reasons it was wrong is that what happens in the real world is that as the air rises, it spins. And he couldn't accept that because that screwed up the model in his head. It wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. So he refused to believe that it's the winds in a tornado spun. And there was another scientist at the time. His name was William Redfield. And he was the first person to discover that hurricanes and large storms rotated. And because of that, he said, well, that's the nature of storms. They spin. And Espy said, no, the nature of storms is that the air rises. And we know now, and this is one of the reasons the fight was so incredibly impassioned and unresolvable, is that we know now they're both right. Mm-hmm. And because they were both right, neither was ever willing to admit to being wrong.
Right.
So, and they actually succeeded in paralyzing American science for a couple of decades because the fight between them got so impassioned and drew in so many supporters on both sides that after a while, nobody was able to do any serious work because the other side would shout them down, not unlike American politics today. And that's a very characteristic thing in American politics and culture, is to completely paralyze yourself with violent opposition. And so the result was, it wasn't until they were both dead, really, that anybody made any further progress.
Was that progress then due to the freeing of the mind from these frozen debates to technological possibilities?
It was more the former. It was more, somebody came up with a theory, his name was William Farrell, that appeared to explain how a tornado could have both rising air and air circulation. And that caused this huge shock among the scientific community and led to this sudden release of energy, because they'd really basically written off the subject at that point. I mean, even one of Espy's supporters said, there's just no point in talking about this anymore until somebody has a new idea. And when years later somebody did have a new idea, it caused this big shockwave. Now, we know now that the new idea wasn't right either, but it was closer to what was really going on, and it was enough to spur the growth of scientific knowledge. Real scientific knowledge of tornadoes, though, didn't actually start happening until the last couple of decades.
Right.
Before then, it was completely speculative.
We're going to come to that in just a moment, but I want to come back to another thread throughout the book that you, or a chord, really, you've both referred to, and it's important to understand, and that is science schmiance. People are living in Kansas and Illinois and these other places.
Yeah.
How are they dealing with the fact that at any moment something could come along and destroy their livelihood, destroy their farm, destroy their home?
That's a really interesting question, because one of the things, one of the ways that the federal government decided to be most helpful to the people settling in the Midwest is to tell them tornadoes weren't a problem at all.
I see.
And they even discouraged, one of the few genuinely practical discoveries they made in the 19th century is that the best place to ride out a tornado is in a storm cellar. And that used to be a common feature of, you know, it's fallen out of favor now, but in those days, people routinely built storm cellars. And the National Weather Service actually discouraged people from building storm cellars. They said that the dangers of catching a cold from the damp in a storm cellar were far worse than the dangers of an actual tornado. And they would issue statistics that said that Iowa, for instance, only got one tornado a year. And, this is, you know.
Was there an anti-tornado lobby or something?
There actually was, And they were real estate people.
Right.
I knew that answer. Yeah.
I think others could guess it.
And there was also, like, not an entirely bad scientific rationale, which was that tornadoes are inherently impossible to predict, which is actually still true now. And so the scaring people about tornado dangers when there was no way of giving them any help about it was maybe not such a good idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that argument really holds up or not, but it's not exactly a dishonorable argument, unlike the real estate issue. So,
those who haven't lived in these areas, and even some who have or do live in these areas, do probably have their most vivid popular culture images from books by L. Frank Baum, sure, and a movie put together from a couple of those books.
Yeah, maybe actually,
you could
the
say
movie.
Something about that.
Yeah, the movie more than the books, actually, because mm-hmm. the books, the tornado, everybody remembers the tornado, but if you actually look at it in the original book,
it's not heavily described.
It's not described at all, actually.
Okay.
I don't think Baum had actually seen a tornado, is my guess.
Mm-hmm.
He just said there was sort of a popular theme in culture then, so I think he just sort of seized upon that. But the movie, The Tornado, they really took a lot of trouble to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
So
they did get it right. Yeah.
Well,
or close
I
to
think
it.
You could argue that it doesn't move right. The mm-hmm. tornado has this kind of strange meandering course
right.
in the movie, which is not really what a real tornadoes tend to move more in straight lines. But visually, it's really an extraordinary creation.
And emotionally, I think that if you talk with other people, people remember the black and white part of the movie as much as they remember
exactly.
the color part.
Maybe even more so,
More so. And that sense of fear, the sense of, but also of, this kind of can-do American organization. All right, we need to do this, this, and this. We need to go down into the cellar.
Exactly.
You know, no, you can't get your little dog.
Yeah, exactly. It caught that feeling of, it's really kind of documentary realism in a way. And I think almost everybody that I've talked to, certainly from my generation, and if they think about a tornado at all, they think about that one.
Right.
And the other thing you have to remember is that very few people had seen tornadoes, and except for eyewitnesses, there was very little documentation.
Mm-hmm.
There were very few photographs up until the advent of the video age. Only one or two pieces of film.
And this is because, in part, the inherent unpredictability.
Yeah.
So in the days when you would need film, and a trained photographer or cinematographer, it's not as if you could just pick up the phone and call and have somebody come because it'll be gone by then.
Yeah, exactly.
But that people can take pictures and films of anything at any time, we see more things?
Well, yeah. Now that we've got this whole video technology and other things like real-time radar and now casting forecasts. I mean, when you go see one of these tornado-chasing crews, I mean, they're going out there with this immense amount of gear, and they're continually wired to the net, and they're continually wired to their sources that are giving them real-time radar. So they're looking for the characteristic tornado shapes. So it's, it's not that hard. Well, it's still tricky, and they often will search for days and not actually see a tornado. But people used to search for years and years and never see a tornado. So,
describe one of these crews to us. I mean, who are these people? Why do they do it? And where do they base themselves? And how do they support themselves?
Well, a bunch of them are academics who are working with universities in Oklahoma. There's the biggest one is in Oklahoma. And a lot of them are just amateurs who are doing it for fun. And now there's this new brigade of sort of tornado safari people who are taking people out on tours. And they're making their money by charging. I mean, if you've got a couple of $1,000 burning a hole in your pocket, you can pay one of these guys to take you around for a week or two. And they won't guarantee that you'll see a tornado, but they will guarantee that you'll see bad weather. And so you spend a week or two just doing nothing but driving around Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas, and not very exciting terrain to cover, but they're looking for violent weather.
Somebody who came at all of this from a wholly different perspective and is a kind of hero, I would say, of the book is somebody who also had a strong Chicago connection, and that is the Japanese astrophysicist Tetsuo Fujita.
Yeah,
Tell us about him.
He was a really interesting guy. He was the way that I arranged the book was to focus on particular chasers at particular periods in history so that people get a sense of how the knowledge evolved, and Fujita kind of comes at the end. He was from Japan, and he'd trained as an engineer. And he'd gotten fascinated by the concept of catastrophic engineering failures. And one of the places where he studied was the aftermath of nuclear blasts, which was the most extreme catastrophic failure possible. But he also became spellbound by what he'd read about American weather and tornadoes. And he became fascinated before he'd ever been to America. And he discovered, studying clouds in the Japanese mountains, the principle that there was a downdraft at the center of a violent storm, which was new. No one had figured that out. And he started sending these papers, laboriously translated into English, to American scientists who had no idea who he was. And it was just this strange thing with these completely novel ideas. And it just so happened that around the time that he did that, a couple of American scientists made the same discovery. So when they were reading Fujita, they were like, oh, this guy's onto it too. And a professor at the University of Chicago, and I'm blanking on his name, I'm sorry, invited him to come to America and arranged for him to get a professorship. And so he spent his life in America studying tornadoes. And he did so his whole career without actually having seen one. Mm-hmm. But he became the leading expert, world's leading expert on tornadoes.
Horace Byers.
Horace Byers, yeah.
And he becomes the world's leading expert, also the world's most known expert, in part because he's the first one to sit down and start coming up. I mean, I don't know that anyone knows the person's first name or where he came from, but everyone knows the word Richter scale.
Sure, yeah.
So Fujita comes up with the Fujita scale.
The Fujita scale of tornado damage, which has now been replaced by one called the enhanced Fujita scale. So it's no longer proper to talk about. It's like an F5, you're supposed to say EF5.
Okay.
But it's still
nobody
his idea.
Nobody thought before then that we needed to judge
there
these things.
There was one guy I found before then in the 19th century who came up with the idea. But unfortunately, most of his other ideas about tornadoes were insane. And he was one of the people who seriously floated the idea, which you still occasionally hear, that you could stop a tornado by blowing it up with dynamite. And he was working for the National Weather Service. And he took a lot of heed from he came up with a lot of novel approaches to tornadoes. But one of his notions was it wasn't enough just to record a tornado touchdown. You had to figure out some way of recording how strong it was, which is the same notion Fujita used.
Benjamin Franklin, I learned from a cousin of mine who, when I was introducing him to some people years ago, and I said, my cousin David is a Civil War buff, and he's a railroad buff, and he's a transportation buff, and he said, and I'm also a weather buff.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
said, you're a what?
Yeah.
He said, a weather buff. And he started telling me about his kind and their newspaper, which has a quote from Franklin at the top, there are two kinds of men, weather-wise and otherwise. Now,
there
I don't
you
know
go.
If that's a real quote.
I don't know. That's, I hadn't encountered that either. But no, I did a podcast from these guys who called up and they said, oh, we're weather people. And I thought, this would be nice. And it turns out these guys are weather buffs the way sports guys are doing. I mean, they're arguing about, with the same passion about like cold fronts as other people are arguing, you know, how are the Bears going to do this year?
Right.
Thinking, you know, it doesn't always have to be a fight. Not everything has to be a fight. But I think a lot of people think, no, if it's not a fight, what are we doing?
Well, in addition to meeting this great array of characters that you will meet in Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers by Lee Sandlin, S-A-N-D-L-I-N, published by Pantheon, and in your grocer's freezer now, or maybe
it's bookstores
or wherever people buy books anymore.
God only knows.
But,
I don't know.
You also do give us, in the end, some practical insights. Because as you've mentioned already, everything we've heard about tornadoes for the most part is wrong. What should one do if one is in Lamont or Wilmette or whatever and there's word of a tornado and it's serious?
Well, if you should first off get reliable information, which is not always easy to do. But now with everything online, it's much easier to tell. And if there is a tornado that is actually imminent, your safest place, they used to have notions like, I don't know whether you heard this growing up, but I certainly did, southwest corner of the basement. Mm-hmm. Sorry, open the windows and
open
go out
the
inside.
Windows. Right.
Opening the windows is the worst possible thing you could do. as they like to say now, don't bother doing that. The tornado will do it for you. and southwest corner of the basement is meaningless too. I mean, these are ideas that were around from the 19th century that never had any scientific basis, but nobody knew any better. Most the studies have shown that almost all the casualties by tornadoes are caused by flying debris. Mm-hmm. So the best thing you can do is take shelter somewhere without windows. A windowless interior room is your best chance of running out a direct hit by a tornado. If you're in the open country, there's this really dangerous idea now that you should look for like a freeway overpass and hide under that. That is catastrophically bad advice because it's famous because somebody got one family rode out a tornado that way. And no one stressed how incredibly lucky they were because freeway overpasses can act like wind tunnels. So the speed of the wind around a tornado can actually speed up underneath one of those. But your best chance is to get into open country and find a ditch or something and lie flat. And there again, cover your head and try to protect yourself from debris. But the bad advice circulates all the time. In the Moore tornado, you know, a weatherman got on TV and said, get in your cars and drive away, which is insane advice in a tornado, especially in an urban setting where the traffic is going to be, you know, jammed up. I mean, the worst possible place to ride out a tornado.
It sounds like something out of Orson Welles'
World. It really is, yeah. He's actually there saying, you know, the catastrophe is coming, get in your cars and flee, and, you know. And I mean, imagine he was just panicked and not thinking clearly. But there again, it shows advice is tricky.
One of the things you can hear from this mini summation here, and it's something that brings us to at least a brief discussion of Lee's previous book on the Mississippi, is how much research you do. And I, as a history person and a researcher and an admirer of those who do these things with thoroughness, your bibliographic sections are really essays and really give us a sense of what you've done to find these things. And what you're really helping us to do is not always necessarily to solve mysteries, but to point out what is a mystery and why our perceptions are sometimes upside down, whether about tornadoes or about the peaceful, happy, lovely. I mean, on our way, each of our ways in today to the studio, we heard the Mississippi River Suite of Florence Price.
Yeah, exactly.
And you very would just gentle, think that the Mississippi was the gentlest thing that ever lived. So I want to switch over to Wicked River, but I also want you to give us some idea, because I think it's parallel for these two books at least, how you go about, I mean, you obviously spend a lot of time in libraries. You spend a lot of time looking at old newspapers.
I spend a lot of time on Google Books is also, and that really, I have to say, as much heat as they get, for a researcher in the 19th century, they're incredible because they have been doing this thing of going around and scanning in books wholesale from the public domain books from the 19th century.
So for the 19th century, you don't have the problem, quote unquote, that you have today with contemporary books, whereas one of 10, maybe they've gotten the permission, it's scanned and it's fully indexable or searchable.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas if it's public domain and if they've gone to the right libraries, they've got the books in there.
Yeah. And so you're able to get it. It's very frustrating because they're doing it kind of haphazardly and not exercising editorial judgment. On the one hand, that's lovely. And on the other hand, it's very often the case that they will have volume two of the three-volume set and not have bothered to scan the other two books.
Right.
And so it's a mixed blessing for research. But, you know, both of these books would have required me to spend several years traveling around to regional libraries to do research. And this, I was able to cut it a little more short and do large amounts of it from my study at home. But it mostly just involves a willingness to plow into this immense volume of primary sources that exist for these periods that people haven't looked at in hundreds of years. I found for the tornado book, the National Weather Service had an online archive of firsthand testimonies from their original weather guys from the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody's looked at that since they put it online, but it's fascinating to see.
One of the things that, of many things that I miss about libraries and card catalogs and checking out books was you would see the card and who and when. And sometimes you would be very excited. You'd see something and it hadn't been checked out in 50 years.
I know,
and you thought, I found it. Or, Professor So-and-so read
this exactly.
Book.
Well, with the River book, I was working on a lot of things that, as far as I can tell from what I was searching for these books and later references, no one has looked at in 150 years.
Now, we should also say that the patients that you're referring to, my guess is in part also important because succinctness was not really a part of 19th century English prose.
No, it really wasn't. No. there were better and worse writers, but it does make you even more impressed by people like Melville and Dickinson, who were pithy. And the 19th century style was very long-winded, very ponderous, very sort of – the humor was always sort of elaborately frivolous in a way that just drives you nuts listening to it after a while.
What got you on not just to the Mississippi but to this sort of maybe it's a cliched sounding phrase but a revisionist history in some ways of the Mississippi?
I don't know. Well, revisionism is an interesting term. I mean, part of the difficulty with that was that I got into the Mississippi as a subject only because I've been writing a lot of things about my family in the Midwest.
Right.
And I found myself sort of drawn back to earlier and earlier times. And the more you do that when you're writing about the Midwest, the more you come up against the Mississippi.
Right.
And so I thought, well, this is a really interesting subject. And then I came across just in an introduction to a book about Twain, somebody mentioned when he wrote about the Mississippi, he actually hadn't been there in more than 20 years.
Right.
And I started thinking, now that's really interesting because everybody takes that book as his books as the definitive examples of what the Mississippi was really like, but they were nostalgia pieces.
Right.
He was looking back, and I started thinking, is it possible to get back at the earlier time and see what it was like firsthand? And what I discovered is that there was this enormous number of writers who'd written about the Mississippi before the Civil War. It was a huge tourist attraction. It was part of everybody's, the Europeans on the Grand American Tour. You had to take the Mississippi River boats. And so there was all of these books, these memoirs, these travel diaries, written about the Mississippi that described it in very visceral, vivid terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, no one's talking about this. Mm-hmm. This is really this amazing source material. And so that's what led me into doing the book.
And what you found was that rather than being placid and beautiful, which there are sections that are, and maybe more so for reasons you explained today, but also it was dirty, scary, and dangerous.
Very dangerous, very chaotic. Dangerous not only for the natural world, but also from the fact that there were so many criminals and pirates on the river. Disease-ridden, it was squalid and dangerous. And this, and the people who were writing about it were describing it. They were dependent on it for the economy. That's how they were staying alive. But they weren't describing it with a lot of affection and the way that Twain did. They weren't sentimentalizing it. They, if anything, they were going pretty far in the other direction. And I just kept on finding these accounts and just thought, this is really a fascinating world. I, after the book was published, a friend of mine said that she would read it, and she would read one page and thought, oh, I wish I were back there. And then she would turn another page and she would think, thank God I'm not back there. And that tension ran through the whole book for me.
This may sound too silly, but I have to ask you, if you were able to talk with Samuel Clemens now, what would you ask him or say to him about life on the Mississippi?
I think that he saw the Mississippi being ruined, essentially. He was, when he was coming in, when he was writing Life on the Mississippi, it was the point at which the Mississippi stopped being a natural river and started being an artificial creation. And which is why the book is called Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. And I think
it is quote tamed as a highway, as a means of commerce and transportation.
Well, it's literally controlled
by
the Army Corps of Engineers.
Right.
I mean, they are literally deciding how every drop of water is getting into the river and what's happening to it. And there were a lot of reasons for doing that. The first question I actually asked myself didn't end up in the book. But I had read a paper by a writer with the Army Corps, an engineer with the Army Corps, about what would happen if they took all their controls off the river. And what would it be like? And it was fascinating because you realized we would find it unlivable. We would find – people in the Midwest would find the Mississippi an intolerable presence if it weren't controlled, in the same way that if we restored the natural environment – and set, you know, saber-toothed tigers running around the Midwest. In that same way, we could say, well, ecologically, it's much better, but it's kind of tough to go to the grocery store when they're lurking in the trees about to pounce on us. And that's what the Mississippi would be like. It would become impassable to traffic almost immediately. It would flood every year, not every 20 years the way that it does now, catastrophically flood. And everything that was traveling on it would have to travel by some other means. And also, it would meander. And this is the thing. Rivers meander. They don't have a fixed course. And the Mississippi used to meander all the time. I mean, it used to meander every day. That was one of the reasons there were so few reliable maps. The maps were out of date within a few days after they were printed. If the Mississippi were let run now, for instance, New Orleans would immediately become landlocked because the river would swerve away from it to the west. And this was known in the 19th century, and it was one of the motives behind the Army Corps taking it over. So to get back to your original question,
is that
if I were to encounter Twain now, I would want to show him what the Mississippi became. And because there's a lot of it now that we don't see. We still have this picture in our mind about what the river is like.
Right.
But if you travel through the lower river valley, there are long stretches of it that are completely industrialized.
Yeah.
It's one of the most heavily developed industrial areas in
the
world.
So that would be in what state or between what
really
states?
Heading up from about Baton Rouge north.
Yeah.
It's called the Mississippi River Industrial Corridor.
Right.
And so they've got an immense amount invested on keeping the river exactly where it is. And which is ecologically not that great an idea, but on the other hand, in practical terms, there's billions of dollars invested in factories there.
So to the extent that Mark Twain was being nostalgic, perhaps he had a reason. Perhaps
he did. The old river, the river that he'd known, it wasn't just culturally that it was gone, although that was true already because the railroads had destroyed the old river life. But the physical river itself was disappearing. And he wrote about that towards the end of Life on the Mississippi. When people read that book, they tend to read his childhood stuff, which is magnificent. But if you press on to the present day stuff, he describes very vividly how the river is getting destroyed. And it was a practical necessity. Everybody thought so, and even Twain kind of thought so. But he was still mourning what the river had been.
I was looking at the website of another writer who writes a lot about the 19th century, Caleb Crane.
Oh, yes.
And his website is called Steamboats Are Ruining Everything.
I've heard of that. I should
because
look at
it's a quote from a 19th century novel by a lesser-known writer where a stowaway boy hears a woman saying, you know, steamboats are ruining everything.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. That's actually pretty good because they kind of did. They ruined the original river culture, which was all, hand-powered boats, basically. The steamboats blew all that away. And then then the river became completely dependent on the steamboats. And when the railroads came in, the steamboats all vanished.
Right. So this idea that whatever the next thing is.
Yeah, it always wrecks.
Ruins
everything. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, surveying the wreckage of tornadoes and rivers, and in a program we'll do it another time, perhaps of families as well.
Sure.
Lee Sandlin, Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers, and Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. Both are published by Pantheon, and both were written right here in Chicago by our guest, Lee Sandlin. And next time when we talk about The Distancers and his family, we'll talk a bit, too, about how Lee became a writer or how he became a published writer. Many of us are writing all the time, maybe from when we first can hold something.
Yeah, I did.
And that doesn't surprise me because you write with great fluidity and you write with great care and, though, with passion, and these books are organized in a narrative, not an artificial narrative fashion, but in a narrative fashion, and I think that makes them, in the old phrase, page-turners. Lee Sandlin, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a-plowing through the ragged skies, and up a cloudy draw. A ghost heard in the sky. Their brands were still on fire and the
music we heard tonight. We opened and closed with the Stan Jones pop country western song written in 1948 and recorded by both Burl Ives and Vaughn Monroe within minutes of each other. Both versions were on the charts at the same time in 1949. So if you're trying to remember which version you heard first in your life, you heard them both, Burl Ives and Vaughn Monroe, Ghost Riders in the Sky. And in the middle, who else but Big Bill Brunsey, 1934 recording of his own Mississippi River Blues. We'd like to thank Lee Sandlin, Hal, and the other folks who have worked with Lee over the time that we took to at last get Lee on the air here. And we will be talking with him about his much more personal book, The Distancers, down the line. We'd like to thank the good folks at Random House, Matt DeStefano for producing, engineering, and making this program sound great, Samuel R. Galloway for his assistance. Our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Drop us a line anytime. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can experience the always free Critical Thinking podcast of this and our other programs. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.